Welcome to the Valor Podcast. I'm Nick Lehman. This is episode one. We're really excited to start our new venture in interviewing veterans, civilians that are helping veterans. And today is our first episode. We were funded by strangers, friends, countrymen, all you can name it. They pitched in and got this podcast up and going. Today, we're going to talk about Arlington Cemetery and the Old Guard. It was founded in May 13th, 1864. Presidents, men and women who died for our country during their service time, and military personnel who earned it. The first military burial occurred at the cemetery in 1864. That was Private William Chrisman. Many consider it sacred ground. There are over 400,000 men and women buried there. And today, we're going to talk to one of the Old Guard soldiers, Tom Tudor. He goes around the country and talks to different groups about his experiences. He served in the late 60s to early 70s. Is that correct?
69 and 70, yes.
Yes. So Tom, thanks for joining us. Thanks for your service. And why don't you tell me a little bit about how you got into the Army and what led you to the Old Guard?
Well, first of all, I had been, as a Boy Scout, at the Boy Scout Jamboree in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania in 1964. I was with the Iowa contingent. I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa. My father was the Boy Scout executive in Des Moines, Iowa, and he had finagled me a job on staff in 64. As I was 16 years old, I was a little bit older than most of the scouts, so I was on staff at the Jamboree. But I went with the Iowa contingent, and we went to Philadelphia after the Jamboree was over, and then to D.C., and one of the first stops in D.C., in the D.C. area, of course, Arlington is on the other side of the river in Virginia, was Arlington National Cemetery. We went to the relatively new Kennedy gravesite, because this in summer 64 was less than a year after John F. Kennedy had been killed, and we went to the tomb, and the tomb was, of course, very impressive. I thought those guys were amazing. Little did I know that within about 5 years I'd be doing the same thing. I got drafted. I fell short of hours at the University of Iowa in 1968. And, of course, that was right after the Tet Offensive in January of 1968. The draft call in June of 68 was the biggest since the Second World War. And I was caught up in that draft and was inducted on the 10th of June of 68. Went to basic combat training at Fort Bliss. Like anybody else who had college, I was sent to infantry school, which would maybe encourage me to want to volunteer for OCS, Officer Candidate School, which I did not. But the second week I was at Fort Ord, I went to a meeting of anybody between the heights of 5'10 and 6'2 who was interested in volunteering for the Old Guard. To go to, and I filled out the card and said that on the back of the card why I wanted to be in the Old Guard, and I said precisely what I just told you, that I had seen the tomb guards in 1964, and if I had a chance to do it, I'd jump at it. And out of 40 guys in my unit that went to that meeting, I was the only guy who got sent to Fort Myer, Virginia.
You must have had a pretty good a case written and a plea.
I guess. I don't know. I was the right size. I was the right weight. They were looking for long, lean guys, and I fit their profile. So,
tell me a little bit about that. I mean, it takes a special person, you know, physically, the look, the emotions, everything that goes into an Old Guard soldier.
Well, Old Guard soldiers in general, and Tomb Guards in particular, are a different breed. You have to have the attributes that I mentioned previously, height, slender, and the ability to withstand a great deal of discomfort. I don't say pain, but discomfort, because guarding the tomb in the summer with wool uniform on in 95 degree heat, 95% humidity,
and a rifle on your shoulder.
And the only skin showing was between your brow and your neck. That took a little bit of ability to tolerate discomfort and extreme discomfort on some days.
And I know a little bit about the badge numbers. I'm not sure. I can't remember how many there are currently, but it says here in your notes that you were number 78.
That's correct.
And so tell the people what that meant.
The Tomb Guard Identification Badge is the badge that tomb guards receive after they have met all the qualifications and served, at least in my day, served as a sentinel in rotation. That means in rotation, walking daily during the daylight hours and at night for 9 months without incident. So I was actually awarded my Tomb Guard badge 9 months out from 15th of February of 1969, so it would have been whatever, nine months, November of 1969 when I was actually allowed to keep that badge. Number 78 is my number. They started them in 1958, so it didn't start with the earliest of the Tomb Guards, which goes back to 1926, but it was codified in 1958. The most recent badge number I'm aware of is 643 that we gave to a Sergeant Ruth Hanks, the fourth female in history to have earned the Tomb Guard Identification Badge. So we don't call ourselves a brotherhood anymore. We call ourselves a fellowship of Tomb Guards. So I'm 78 out of 643. When I talk to guys who are in the 400 and 500s, they say, "Gee, you're old."
Or seasoned lumber. So yes, I think that's
there you go. It's a little bit of a point of pride to have an early number, I guess, and within the ranks of the society that I'm a member of.
Yeah, you're under 100. So I think that has some like nobility to it. So it's, you know, not to compare government agencies, but the Arlington Cemetery is literally like the Postal Service. Rain, snow, sleet, shine, that you guys are always there.
The first 24-hour guard was posted midnight July 2nd, 1937. And it was in response to the fact that though the tomb had been guarded in the daytime since 1926 by the U.S. Army, that it was discovered in 1937 that people were coming up at night when the tomb was unguarded with hammers and chisels and knocking pieces off the wreaths and the figures and the corners to take home as souvenirs. And midnight July 2nd, 1937, a 24-hour guard was posted, and the tomb has been guarded ever since, 24/7, no lapses, regardless of weather. We had hurricanes, Bob, Isabel, Irene, Sandy, during Isabel, and this was there was an email that went around about this that was a little bit erroneous, that said that the guards were ordered off post and refused to go. The guards were not ordered off post. They were given a contingency plan to withdraw to the National Memorial Amphitheater Trophy Room, which is within sight of the tomb. You can look out the window and see the tomb if trees started coming down that were endangering the tomb guards. Nobody I know who has ever guarded the tomb would ever be that person to walk away. So it's a point of pride that the guys who stayed out in the conditions that they did. And I think I would have been the same. I would not have had any notion of walking away if I were called up at 1 o'clock in the morning to do my 2 hours during the middle of a hurricane.
Well, I wouldn't say it was a pride. I think of more being a patriot and understanding what that tomb means and the history of it.
Well, when I say pride, I mean pride in country as well as pride in yourself and the job that the tomb guards are able to accomplish.
Yeah, what are some of the things? I mean, you said sometimes you had to guard the tomb at 1 in the morning, and that has to be pretty lonely out there.
Well, we went to 2 hour shifts. 1 hour shifts during the daytime, back in my day. Now, in the late 70s, they went to half hour shifts, April 1st to October 1st, because some of the old guys like to say because the new guys aren't as tough as the old guys. But I think it was the driving reason was there were getting to be so many people accumulating and a changing of the guard that only the first few rows could actually see and get a photograph. So they redesigned the front of the amphitheater. Supplied more viewing areas and went to guard changes on the top of the hour and the bottom of the hour, otherwise 9 and 9:30, 10 and 10:30, so that more people could see the changing of the guard. They had more guards, therefore, because they were rotating through faster. So the reliefs went from four guys, which was my standard, four sentinels, to I think they now have 7 or 8 sentinels on a relief that rotate through whatever their rotation is. So, does that answer? Am I getting at it?
Yeah. And I mean, being there, you know, I know you have the other people that you're serving with in terms of the Army, but the public's not there at night. That has to be pretty surreal.
Actually, it is. I loved it at night, especially when the full moon was out. And people say, wasn't that spooky to be in with all those graves, that 400,000 buried in Arlington National Cemetery? Now, there were less then, but I found it very, very emotional and very spiritual. And when the moon was full and you were out there by yourself at midnight and it was just you and the three unknowns, that's pretty special. And that's a feeling that I cannot really put to words, except to say that it was a transcendent experience to be a 20-year-old kid and have that duty and that responsibility and to realize where you were and what you were actually doing.
Yeah, and I mean I would probably be in the same boat. I mean the history, the stories, the, you know, it's hard to put a number on how many were actually buried back then, but you know, now it's like 400,000 stories of sacrifice, courage, honor, you know, the whole military mantras.
Right.
And you know, it gives me chills, and I imagine you actually being in uniform and performing the duties, was it almost like a pinch me moment, because it's like the
absolutely, you know, here's a kid from Des Moines, Iowa. What the heck am I doing here in Arlington National Cemetery and having being in charge of protecting one of our nation's most sacred shrines, if not the most sacred shrine that we have to those who have fought and died in our wars. The unknowns, of course, being in a special class in that they'd lost not only their lives but lost their identities as well, and that's especially emotional for us.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about the history of the unknown. My wife and I were kind of reading, talking about it, that, you know, certain people were chosen from different wars and they were put in the tomb.
The original, the first unknown, and the concept of selecting one individual to represent all those who were missing in a given war. For example, the Great War, the First World War, we had 3,350 missing. We had 1,230 sets of remains that we could not match up with any of the names of the missing. So we did a process. And the process was sort of copied after the French and the British model, which had done it 1 year before in 1920, because the losses of the French and the Brits were huge compared to our losses in those wars. The French, 1.4 million, Brits, 934,000. We had 116,000 that lost their lives. So, but we followed their model and made sure that there was no way that anybody living could know who was in that casket. So what we did in the World War I unknown, and this was the pattern, this is the precedent, we chose at random an unknown from each of 4 different American cemeteries. They were double checked to make sure that they bore no insignia of rank or unit that could possibly identify them. The paper records pertaining to those graves were incinerated, so that nobody could go back and say, well, hey, look, this guy came out of here and maybe it's him or him. And they were placed in 4 identical caskets. In the middle of the night at the place of selection, the morning of October 24th, 1921, the caskets were shuffled so that somebody who thought this one had come from this cemetery, the Muzargon Cemetery, for example, was over here, actually, because they had been shuffled just like a shell game, and they had had 2 different crews shuffle. So the first crew thought they had knew the shuffle, the second crew thought they knew the shuffle, but nobody knew that the first and second crews were aware of each other. So, you know, that's the kind of special care they took to make sure that there would be no way to identify that person. So the selection took place on the morning of the 24th of October. A spray of white roses was laid on one of the 4 by Sergeant Edward F. Younger, who is buried in Arlington National Cemetery, by the way, and that became our unknown. The other three were reburied in the Muzargon Cemetery, and he came across the ocean on the USS Olympia to Arlington. And on the 11th of November, the third anniversary of the signing of the armistice, he was interred with great ceremony.
And that, I mean, just your knowledge is just amazing. Did you have to learn all that when you were in the old guard, or is this kind of your research and previous?
We had a fair volume of information that we had to know, and I have over the years added to that my personal information. I've read every modern book on Arlington history. There are some that were written, you know, back in the 1800s that would not be appropriate, would not have the perspective of today's books. But one book in particular that I have read three times is called On Hallowed Ground by Robert Poole, and I know Robert. He was at one of our reunions, and I have his book signed, and I email him on occasions when I have questions that I say, "Hey, Bob, what's your take on this?" And so I have been blessed with a good memory, and every night before I go to bed after dinner, I go out and research some aspect or some person buried at Arlington, what I include in my long presentations, which I'm doing tonight at UNM Gallup, will be about 40 minutes on who's buried in Arlington. And it's an amazing collection of people that, first of all, some of them you don't associate in any way with the military.
It's like the who's of American pop culture and...
Well, Maureen O'Hara, George Westinghouse, Ludwig Bemelmans. Now, you're gonna have that bewildered look on your face when I say Ludwig Bemelmans. But most people who have daughters have read Ludwig Bemelmans' books because he wrote the Madeline books.
Well, yep. Makes sense now. I think my daughters have checked them out at the library here and there. Yeah.
So, the list goes on and on. And, of course, the obvious military people, 12 Supreme Court justices, 5 of the 9 generals and fleet admirals of the World War II who got the 5th star. 5 of the 9 are buried in Arlington. Just an amazing collection of American heroes and a few villains in there, too.
Yeah, and I think there's even slaves buried there, too, as well, isn't that?
The old Section 27, which is in the north end of the cemetery and is just across the low brick wall from the park in which the U.S. Marine Memorial is, the Iwo Jima Memorial, is the oldest section in Arlington. And it contains escaped slaves. It contains slaves who died while in the area, and specifically in a place called Freedmen's Village, which was located on the property, the big property, not the cemetery itself, but the big property that was occupied by Robert E. Lee and his wife, owned by his wife's family, not him, ever. But there were many burials there, including one that took place in January of 1864 of Henry Johnson, and he was Lincoln's valet, William Henry Johnson, I'm sorry. He was Lincoln's valet who went with him to Gettysburg. Lincoln fell ill at Gettysburg of smallpox. Johnson helped nurse him back to health, contracted smallpox himself, died in January of 1864, and was buried there in January of 1864, and that was still 4 months before any military burials took place at Arlington National Cemetery.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, it sits on over 600 acres. I mean, there's, you know, when you were there, I mean, I've gone to a couple military funerals, you know, here at our local state, their military cemeteries, and I've seen them done at, you know, the private cemeteries that bring the guard out and all that. It's very, very, I don't even know how to describe it. I mean, it's very crisp and honorable, and you know what goes through a military funeral as a guy that's sort of overseeing them, performing them for these families.
The overwhelming desire is to be perfect, because this is the last ceremony, the last activity that will be taken on that person's behalf or for that person. And so because they served, then we do the best, our very best, to be precise. And precise in the ceremonial way, so that that anybody witnessing this feels honored, feels that their loved one has been truly honored by the care which has been taken to put them to rest.
Does that require practice with your team members?
I was on, before I was assigned to the tomb, you didn't just show up at the battalion and say, I want to be a tomb guard, because you had to go prove yourself in some of the capacities. And the three major ones were marching platoon, which every escort to the grave gets some full military honors, gets a marching platoon. The casket bearers, they had their own routine that they practiced, and the shooters. And those are the riflemen who shoot the three volleys of seven.
Also known as the 21-gun salute.
Well, it is sort of a, the 21-gun salute originally was a cannon salute of naval origin, and the volley was originally three volleys, didn't matter how many, and that was to indicate that the Civil War battlefield was clear now, that we had reclaimed our dead, and we're done. So it's that sort of got intermingled along the way, that the 7 times 3 equals 21. Somebody said, well, I know it's 21 because 1776 add up to 21, and that is just a fluke. That is a happenstance. The 21-gun salute evolved over about a 400-year period through primarily naval protocol and naval history.
And so, I saw a documentary, I think it was on National Geographic or the History Channel about Arlington and what the old guard goes through. And one of the scenes that really stuck out with me is there was the soldiers, they were standing there, they were getting everybody's uniform, like, nice, slick, perfect, like you were saying, and they had lighters and they were getting the stitches. Is there something that you did back in the day that you still do now that is just kind of muscle memory?
I polished the tongue of my shoe. We always spit shined the tongue of our shoe. Well, who is ever going to see the tongue of your shoe? You. And maybe your relief commander, and maybe the sergeant of the guard if he just happens to be walking by, or maybe the good Lord.
Well,
but you will. But you know.
In Shawshank Redemption, that nobody looks at your shoes.
You know that it's been done. And that was the sort of attitude that we took was, you can err, if you're going to err on the side of too much rather than too little.
And so walking that site, I mean, it has to be breathtaking. I mean, I haven't been. It's on my must-see to the things to do when I go to the East Coast. I mean, but seeing those white marble stones and just seeing all the names and their, the wars that they were in, the medals they earned. What kind of sights and sounds that really drew you and just made you feel like, man, I was really meant to do this?
Well, there are 25 to 30 funerals a day in the cemetery. And when we guard the tomb, you hear, you go out for a walk, you're walking 1 hour, and you hear three rifle volleys. That's three individuals who served our great nation have been laid to rest. And that's sort of marking time. And time almost, in a way, stands still at Arlington, although everything we do is timed to the second. It's an amazing, just a demarcation. Every day, Monday through Friday, there are 25 to 30 funerals in Arlington. Saturday, between 6 and 8, and zero on Sunday. But Sunday was always quiet because you didn't hear any of the no rifle volleys, and a little bit of a special respite time in Arlington were the Sundays.
And if somebody goes and visits, what are some common things or some things to keep in mind? Because as you say, there's 25 funerals. That's 25 stories that are, in a sense, coming to an end. And there's a mourning family. How can you be respectful but still go to a national historic ground?
I think that when you go, there are certain expectations, and when you approach the tomb, there's almost an aura that you can cut with a knife that requires silence and respect. And if somebody was acting up, behaving, being loud, we had, the Sentinel has warnings and admonitions. And in our day, it is requested that visitors maintain a mature and reverent attitude in the vicinity of the tomb. You could do that as loud as you could say it, and that usually shut them up or made them rethink their behavior.
A humble pie.
And there is when there are other visitors, there is peer pressure. There are people looking at you if you're acting like a jerk, and as they should be. I think it's sort of a self-contained attitude within the cemetery that almost dictates that you're not here to act up. You can't walk a dog, you can't jog, you can't ride a bike through the Arlington Cemetery. It is a place where you don't have picnics, and that goes back to the first reason that the tomb was guarded in 1926, where the tomb of 1921 was this low table looking thing. It wasn't what we know now that was placed in 1931. And somebody found a family having a picnic lunch on top of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and went to the White House and demanded that a guard be placed on, and then President Calvin Coolidge agreed and placed a civilian guard on in November of 1925. The Army took over in March of 26.
And the recent thing that has come out, I don't know if you've seen the big craze about that Pokemon Go, the Arlington has come out and said, don't do that here. Like, go find somewhere else in the public. So it's an app game on your phone. People go around.
Yes, I've seen that. And generationally, I could care less, personally. I think anything that would be allowed in a distraction certainly should be not allowed in the cemetery. Carrying of placards or flags is not allowed unless you are authorized military personnel, unless it is a small flag for an individual grave. That you cannot carry flags or placards in the cemetery or protest in the cemetery. It is verboten.
And it seems like this cemetery and this historical place is a place where you just stop, listen, and watch. It's something that you just don't hurry. You just take your time with.
You know, I wish more people would take time, because one of the reasons I include who's buried in Arlington in my long presentations is so many people are in a tour bus. They jump out at the JFK gravesite. They don't even go over to see, oh, I didn't know Bobby was here. I didn't know Ted was here. And I didn't know there was a stone for Joseph Jr. right next to the left of Ted. Well, there is. And I didn't know Abner Doubleday was buried here. Yes, he is. But they don't see that. They go to the tomb, they go to the JFK, the tomb. Maybe they go to the Arlington House and get the little tour of the Arlington House. But they have no inkling. As you're walking up, if you walk up to the Kennedy gravesite to the right and you're paying attention, you can see six Supreme Court justices buried in within about a 50-foot radius.
Oh, that's amazing. That's so much history there. I mean,
absolutely.
And so, Tom, tell us how you can find out more information about yourself and how to book your education
Well, I can be contacted through my website. Also, the Society of the Honor Guard, Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, has a website. That's tombguard.org. And depending on where you are in the country, if we have a former Sentinel, who is willing to do presentations close to you, we try to do the best we can to get them to you. I'm current president of the society for another 6 months. And so I work well with a guy in Great Falls, Montana, who has for a long time been matching up Sentinels with requests. I'm in Colorado, and I get around. Of course, I'm not too far away from home here in Gallup. But I do some traveling. This is my 17th state I've spoken in. So,
are you going to go for 50? Is that the?
Well, you know, I know the hard one's going to be Alaska or Hawaii, but
hard but easy.
Yeah. Well, actually, I had until I spoke at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans on Memorial Day. I was one of two featured speakers for their Memorial Day program. And Louisiana was the only state that I, of the lower 48, that I had not been in. So I got my last, my 48th, been to Hawaii, but never Alaska. And I have not spoken in Hawaii, although if I do go to Hawaii, I, as a Rotarian, I if I want to speak somewhere and I know in advance, I can, people love to have somebody come in and talk about firsthand experience as a tomb guard at Arlington.
Definitely. And to go on to that, on Memorial Day, speaking of Memorial Day, Memorial Day was the last day you served at the tomb, correct? Is it?
Yeah, it was sort of a double whammy because we got off my last, I started duty on the 29th at 7 a.m. and got off on 7 a.m. on the 30th. And that was the last year by law that Memorial Day was on the 30th. The Federal Holidays Act of 1968 gave us these wonderful three-day weekends by making Memorial Day not the 30th anymore, which it had been since its founding as Decoration Day in 1868, by the way, originated at Arlington by General John Logan, who was Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic, that veterans organization on the Union side. From 1868 until 1971, the 30th was set aside for a day to honor our war dead. And now it's a weekend to have a barbecue or sell, buy furniture or, you know.
Used cars.
Yeah, right. Whatever they want to sell. And do you, and extend that sale another 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah, and then it goes into the July 4th. Is there anything that you remember of that day that you take away?
That 29th, we had wreath layings. Lots of wreath layings, because as Memorial Day approaches, everybody wants to come lay a wreath. And we had, in 1970, still quite a few World War I veterans living, because they were all born in around 1900. So these guys were in their 70s. And they were organized into a group called the Military Order of Cooties. And if you want to find some interesting stuff, look up Military Order of Cooties. These were the guys who were in the trenches, the doughboys in the trenches, 1917 and 1918. And they organized themselves into groups called pup tents. Not post, not VFW post, but pup tent. And they would have a name. And the pup tent's names, some of them I would not repeat in polite company. And I am standing there as relief commander next to the guy who was from the blank blank pup tent. And I am trying to not bust up because these names are...
Because you're a guard. You got to be solemn.
And we're in this solemn ceremony, and this ridiculous name comes out of somebody's mouth, and I'm saluting their wreath. So that was challenging and interesting. And of course, sadly, the last February 27th, 2011, the last of the Frank Buckles, the last of the World War I veterans, died and is buried in Arlington, and not too far from John J. Pershing. Who was the first officer to choose to be buried with his enlisted men, and that set a precedent that has been that is now you go in Section 60, which is the recent burials, and it's enlisted and officers mixed in together. It's there's no hierarchy like there was back in the day. The early very first burials in Section 27. Private William Henry Chrisman, and on the next day, Private William Blatt, the first combat death buried at Arlington, were buried up in 27, and that's where the escaped slaves, that's where the U.S. colored troops were buried. There was that great divide between enlisted and officers. The officers got buried around the edge of Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden. The enlisted got up in 27 with the slaves and the contrabands.
And finally, it says here on that soldiers never die until they are forgotten, tomb guards never forget. A couple words sum that up in a...
Well, we made our career on thinking about and feeling what the unknowns were maybe had gone through. And to get out of the Army and to forget about them or to abandon them, even though I've been out for 46 years, we will always remember. The Tomb Guards will be there as long as there is the United States of America. I was asked, you know, when will we quit guarding the tomb? Well, there won't be any more unknowns. When are we going to quit guarding the tomb? And my response is, when there is no longer a United States of America, we will guard it, and the Tomb Guards will be there till the end.
Well, Tom, beautiful interview, beautiful history. I mean, I think it's a must-see for any American to go to see Arlington. And, you know, thank you for joining us here at the Valor Podcast. Thanks for listening. You can find us on Google Play, iTunes. You can go to thevalorpodcast.com, find us on Facebook. And finally, find your mission. Don't quit. Find something that you can get involved in, help a veteran organization or even a veteran. I'm Nick Lehman, and until next time, have a great week.